Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi, everybody. We're awaiting Supreme Court rulings any time now. But rather than sit around and speculate, let's begin in another courtroom, the George Zimmerman trial in Florida. We followed the tragic shooting of Trayvon Martin closely after it happened last year, as many of you remember, and the failure to arrest Zimmerman at first because of Florida's stand-your-ground law. Remember, it took a national protest movement to get local police and prosecutors to revisit the case. So let's follow the trial, too. Opening statements and the first witness testimony took place yesterday. And with us for this is Jamie Floyd, a lawyer and longtime anchor for Court TV. She's done analysis of the Zimmerman case for MSNBC and BET, and she's a former Clinton administration official and, as many of you know, a frequent substitute host of this program. Hi, Jamie. Welcome back to the guest's chair.
Hello, Brian.
Let's begin with jury selection, even though it was last week. In the case of a Latino male who shot a black male, the jury they could agree on was all female and almost all white. Five white women and one Latino woman, I guess. Is that a coincidence?
No. Jury selection is never a coincidence, and never is the resultant jury a coincidence. Now, as a matter of constitutional law, we are not permitted as lawyers to consider race overtly in court. But of course, Brian, I don't think I'll be sanctioned by the bar for saying that we lawyers always do in a racially charged case. And Florida is relatively unique. There are only six states in the union that have six-person juries. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1970 that it is constitutional for a defendant to be tried by a six-person jury. Until that time, it was always 12-person juries, and we assumed that was required constitutionally, but now you can be tried, even in a murder case, by a six-person jury. So this jury is rather unique. You have, as you point out, a jury that is essentially all white. One woman has identified herself as multiracial, only six people, and all women. And this is relatively unique.
They can't legally choose a juror on the basis of race or disqualify one on the basis
of race,
though I understand what you were saying about wink, wink. Can they legally choose on the basis of gender?
No. The judge, if she sniffs out any of what we call those suspect classes, things that the U.S. Supreme Court has held to be suspect classes, race, gender, and one would think things that even have not been held to be suspect classes, disability, sexuality. You're not supposed to pick a juror based on status. You're supposed to pick them based on whether or not they can be fair in this case. But remember, Brian, you get a certain number of peremptory challenges. You can strike a juror for no reason at all that you have to show to the judge.
Right. Why six jurors? What does Florida get by going to that system?
Well, it's more efficient. You get to the jury quicker. And so the system doesn't grind to a halt in jury selection. And there are a lot of advantages to moving the system along more quickly. We know that the system is overburdened. We've got 2.5 million people in prison in this country, and I guess some argument to be made to getting there quickly. I personally would prefer to have 12 if I'm sitting in judgment, or if 12 people are sitting in judgment of me. I'd rather have 12 of them than six if I'm tried for murder. But that is constitutional according to the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right. Well, the prosecution pretty much began its opening statement yesterday with an F-bomb. Did you see that?
Oh, yes. I watched it over and over again. Highly unusual, very compelling. Jaws dropped in the jury box. We can't see the jury on national television, but those in the courtroom said that several of the jurors were quite shocked by it, and people in the courtroom were, and I think people watching on television were. To have a prosecutor or any lawyer curse in court is highly unusual, but he said to the jury, after he apologized for using that language, these were George Zimmerman's words used about people like Trayvon Martin. These are not my words, and I want you to understand the state of mind of this defendant on the night in question.
Effing punks,
yes.
Those A-holes always get away. How did they know that he said that?
Well, this was on a recorded conversation on the night in question. There were several 911 calls made, non-emergency 911 calls, and then later in the course of the evening, emergency 911 calls, one made later in the course of the evening by Zimmerman himself, and then several percipient witnesses called into 911. So this jury will be listening to a number of phone calls, but some of those were played yesterday during the opening statements. Now, Brian, nothing played during opening statements is evidence. Evidence has to be brought in through testimony. But the lawyers can play these for dramatic effect to give the jury a sense of what the evidence will be. Now, the prosecutor didn't play anything for the jury. He only used drama in his language, and he spoke only for 30 minutes. The defense played a number of pieces of audio tape for the jury, and that opening statement was 2.5 hours long, and it included the now infamous knock-knock joke at the very beginning of the opening statement.
I read that the defense's opening argument lasted 3 hours. What did they
almost,
do for all that time?
Well, there were two very different styles. The prosecution's opening statement was like something you would see on Law and Order, very scripted, very compelling. He didn't look at a piece of paper for even a moment. He must have practiced this thing over and over again in his sleep. It was really masterful, and it was textbook. The defense attorney was much more folksy, very bumbling, like a college professor. He was fumbling around with his posters and his notes. But, you know, some of that may have been very deliberate. The only audience these lawyers care about, Brian, are the six women in that jury box. And remember, we're talking about a southern jury. This is northern Florida, which is very close to southern Georgia. And he knows his audience. And that folksy style, that long, laconic, let-me-spin-you-a-story style, though it did not appeal to a lot of the East Coast pundits and legal analysts like myself, may have worked very well for this jury. Although the knock-knock joke, everyone seems to agree, fell flat with the jury.
What was that knock-knock joke?
Knock-knock, who's there? George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman, who? Good, you're on the jury.
Right, gotcha.
And you just don't tell a joke in the middle of a murder trial.
And someone that's dead. to the jurors who got impaneled through that alleged system.
Right. First of all, you're insulting their intelligence.
Right.
You don't know who George Zimmerman is. Good, you're on the jury. And secondly, you have the parents of this young man who's been killed. Even if you claim your client is not guilty or innocent, it's not the place for a joke. So that was a mistake, but this is the very, very beginning of a long process, and I think they can recover, and even in the opening statement, I think, recovered fairly well from that poor decision to tell a joke at the beginning. He was trying to get away from the very heavy, somber mood created by the prosecution's opening statement.
Jamie Floyd, legal analyst with us as we talk about the George Zimmerman murder trial and the shooting of Trayvon Martin, which opened yesterday. Why did Zimmerman carry his gun in the first place to pursue Martin? Will that be an issue?
Well, he wasn't there to pursue Martin. He was going to Target. This fellow was a neighborhood watch captain. He had, in fact, organized this neighborhood watch group for this residential community. He was registered to carry this gun in Florida, and he was on his way to Target when he spotted Trayvon Martin. And today, this may give you some insight into what happened that night, or maybe it won't, but today the argument in court is that George Zimmerman had called 911 50 times on 50 prior occasions about complaints, concerns, things that bothered him in the neighborhood. He was a very zealous, or prosecutors would say overzealous, neighborhood watch captain.
And how about reasonable cause to pursue Martin? Is
right.
there any indication Martin was doing anything suspicious? Will the defense be able to introduce anything
yes.
to that effect?
In the opening statements, the defense suggested that Martin was traveling a path through the community that was not a path that one would normally take. He was going the back routes behind the houses, as opposed to walking the main route in the path. Now, of course, Martin didn't live there. He was visiting his father, who was staying with his girlfriend. The father was staying with the father's girlfriend, and Martin was a visitor. He didn't know, arguably, which way to walk through this community. It was dark, it was night, it was raining, and he was cutting through the back way to get home from having gone to buy the Skittles and the Arizona iced tea. But from Zimmerman's point of view, the defense will say this was suspicious. Why is he taking this back path? Is he a burglar? Is he a robber? Is he up to no good? And they will argue that Zimmerman was reasonably suspicious and, as a neighborhood watch captain, correct to keep an eye on or perhaps even pursue the young man in the hoodie.
So here's the scenario I can't get out of my mind, Jamie. Let's say Zimmerman pursued Martin for no good reason, walking one way or another way through the complex. I'm not sure that's considered much of a good reason. I guess that'll be up to the jury. But Martin thought he was being, in the scenario that I'm laying out, Martin thinks he's being accosted by a thug.
Yes.
So he begins to fight to protect himself or to prevent a mugging. And Zimmerman shoots him in what by that point was self-defense by Zimmerman. But Zimmerman caused that reasonable reaction on Martin's part to start the fight. If that all turns out to be what's demonstrated in court, in that scenario, guilty or not guilty?
In Florida, that's probably self-defense because of stand your ground. And that's exactly why there has been so much controversy over stand your ground. You have put your finger on the tremendous controversy of stand your ground. Because in most places, you cannot invoke self-defense, Brian, if you have pursued and created the confrontation that results in the loss of life. But here, as you suggest, Zimmerman follows Martin, struggle ensues, and the unanswered question for the jury is whether at some point in the confrontation, even if Trayvon gains the upper hand, and Zimmerman does fear for his life and fires, is that self-defense? Well, in Florida, it is.
Zimmerman wasn't originally arrested because police gave him the benefit of the doubt under stand your ground. That's why the national protest movement sprung up in the first place over a local incident between two guys. So will they, in effect, be debating the correctness of the law as a matter of policy through this trial of an individual?
Well, there are several implications of your question. He wasn't arrested in part because of stand your ground. I think arguably also because the victim was black, and there is a devaluation of black life in many parts of our country, not just in Sanford, Florida. And the perpetrator, suspect, potential arrestee, whatever you want to call George Zimmerman, was apparently white. But also, Brian, many people don't realize his father is a municipal judge in that area, so he had some connections. So there are other complicating factors. Mm-hmm. Had Zimmerman been black, it might have been a different story. Had Trayvon Martin been white, I think it would have been a very different story. So there are complicating factors. But to get back to your question about whether this trial will be some sort of referendum on stand your ground, I don't know. There has been a review of stand your ground in Florida. Stand your ground will remain the law in Florida as of now. There has been a review of stand your ground in other states, and some other states have begun to revise their law on self-defense. So I think generally there has been some good that has come out of this case, but I don't think the trial itself will make much of a difference in terms of the larger policy implications, and trials rarely do. Trials are very small microcosms for the larger legislative changes that we need to see happen.
And those,
we have to have a larger dialogue amongst the leadership of our country to see change occur.
And as we talk about day one of the George Zimmerman murder trial and the killing of Trayvon Martin with legal analyst Jamie Floyd, let's take a phone call, 212-433-WNYC. Vic in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, Vic.
Hi. I just want to know, according to Stand Your Ground, can you start a fight? And therefore, if you start losing the fight, then kill the person.
There are exceptions. A great question. There are exceptions to Stand Your Ground. First of all, there are no exceptions if you're in your home or in your car. And in fact, that's generally the case in self-defense anywhere in the country. You never have to retreat if you're in your home, even here in New York City or in New Jersey, any of our tri-state area jurisdictions. You have the right to defend yourself in your home or in your car. In most stand your ground jurisdictions, you cannot start a fight and then claim you were standing your ground. I started the fight, but then I was standing my ground. This case, however, Vic, is a little bit different because George Zimmerman was a neighborhood watch guy, and he wasn't, he's going to claim he wasn't starting a fight with Trayvon Martin. He was keeping an eye on him,
but he
and
was...
Trayvon jumped him.
Right.
That's what he's going to claim.
Right.
Now, if it can be proved that he jumped Trayvon Martin, then, Vic, you're exactly right. He doesn't get the benefit of stand your ground.
But, again, to go back to my scenario, if they establish that he was not just keeping an eye on Trayvon Martin, but pursuing him and perceived by Trayvon, who wasn't doing anything wrong, to be under pursuit, and so Trayvon turns on him in an act of self-defense to prevent what
right.
he thinks is going to be an assault, that's covered under stand your ground, isn't it?
It is, but here's the difficulty with the situation, and I have to confess, this is, in fact, why I went to law school. This case is very, very difficult for those of us who are, wrap ourselves in the tradition of the civil rights movement, which I do, but at the same time believe in a defendant's right to a fair trial and his right to enjoy the presumption of innocence. In the end, there are only two people who really know what happened, and one of those two people is dead. And the jury is going to be told that unless the prosecution can prove to us what happened between those two people, Zimmerman gets the presumption of innocence. The prosecution has the burden of proving what happened. And as much as I think back on Emmett Till, and I really believe that we have racial profiling that goes on, and they're not allowed to use the words racial profiling in this trial, by the way. And I'm very concerned. I have a sense of what I think happened between Trayvon and Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that in that court of law, there is a responsibility for the prosecution to prove what happened. And if they can't prove it, the jury has a responsibility to honor our Constitution, as painful as that might be for me as a black citizen in America. Am I making sense, Brian?
You are making total sense. And I hear your pain, and I hear your intellect, and to be, greatly, greatly respected. And we'll see how it goes in the jury room. Mary C. in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Yes, my question is that being that Zimmerman was told when he first called that they didn't want him to pursue Martin.
Yes.
And he went ahead and did it anyway. Will that be of relevance to this trial?
Jamie, what do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the worst pieces of evidence for the defense, Mary, and that's an excellent question, is the moment in the tape where you hear the dispatcher in a very calm, dispassionate voice saying, "Are you following Trayvon Martin or this young man?" They don't know he's Trayvon Martin yet. And Zimmerman says, "Yeah, I can see him." And the dispatcher says, we don't need you to do that, sir," in a very calm voice. And you can hear the dispatcher understands who he's dealing with. He's dealing with sort of an overzealous, maybe well-meaning, maybe not, but just a guy who's going to make trouble if he continues to pursue this young man. And the dispatcher is trying to defuse the situation by getting Trayvon Martin to go back to his car. Getting George Zimmerman to go back to his car. And he starts to deal with Zimmerman very precisely. "Sir, I want you to go to the mailboxes. I want you to go to your car. I want you to go somewhere else and meet the police officers who are on their way to deal with the situation." And Zimmerman, you start hearing him breathe a little more heavily on the tape because he's moving around now. He can't pursue Trayvon in his vehicle because Trayvon's moving through the development. And he's gotten out of his car, and he's walking around. And the dispatcher is calm but clearly aware that trouble is going to happen. if he doesn't get Zimmerman to another location away from the young man who's moving through the development. So you're absolutely right, Mary, with your question. That is a key piece of evidence. Sir, we don't need you to do that. We are law enforcement. You are not. And that's a very bad fact for Zimmerman, because it suggests, as Brian has asked throughout this conversation, that Zimmerman pursued Trayvon Martin. And if you pursue, any reasonable jury is going to think, well, maybe you don't have a right to stand your ground if you're the one who's pursuing this kid who's armed only with Skittles and an iced tea.
Right. And so the skill of the attorneys is really going to come into play if the line is that fine.
It's a fine line. It's a hard case for this jury, and it's a very hard case for the lawyers. And I want to say something for the prosecution here, Brian, because I'm very much a defense attorney, and I've traditionally been very skeptical of prosecutors who in our country have worked. If you go back to the civil rights movement, the 50s, the 60s, they worked with the Sovereignty Commission to ensure that these kinds of cases ended in acquittal. And there has been a suggestion down in Florida that these prosecutors didn't want to bring this case, that they haven't charged it properly because they're hoping there will be an acquittal. There is no doubt in my mind when I watched that opening statement yesterday that Mr. Guy is fully committed to this prosecution. I'm not saying that they're right or they're wrong or that they've charged it correctly. I'm not trying to take a point of view.
But they're not taking a dive.
They are not taking a dive.
All right. Jamie Floyd, legal analyst. Jamie, before you go, I'm going to have you sit in here and listen at least while I read the description from our news team of the Voting Rights Act decision, which has just come down from the Supreme Court. And I know you haven't been able to look at this yourself, so if you don't want to react to this, you don't have to. We have other guests coming up later. But here it is. The Supreme Court has ruled now in the case of Shelby versus Holder, the Voting Rights Act. The ruling, Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional.
Wow.
Its formula can no longer be used as a basis for subjecting jurisdictions to preclearance, which is the method by which the federal government approves any changes to voting in certain parts of the country with a history of racial discrimination. The opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts, no surprise, 5-4 split along the usual ideological lines. The majority justices write, our decision in no way affects the permanent nationwide ban on racial discrimination in voting found in Section 2. We issue no holding on Section 5 itself, only on the coverage formula. And this is where it gets a little bit intricate, wonky but historic, as Emily Bazelon from Slate wrote to us a minute ago. Congress may draft another formula based on current conditions, unquote. So in essence, Jamie, it seems like in striking down the formula by which the federal government decides when to intervene, it has struck down Section 5, the preclearance requirement for changes in voting laws in these jurisdictions with histories of racial discrimination. At the same time, the court has affirmed the idea of a nationwide ban on racial discrimination and the idea that there could be an acceptable formula. So they seem to be saying the original formula was developed in the 1960s. It's now up to Congress, putting this in Congress's court, to develop a new formula for these conditions 50 years later, reinvestigating whether different states or different localities have recent enough histories of racial discrimination that they need to submit their voting law changes to the federal government for preclearance. And, Jamie, my first reaction to this is that it puts Congress in a very difficult position because Congress, as you know, reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, including Section 5, recently by a very, very wide margin.
Right.
But if they now have to go back and re-debate the formula, which is going to make it easier or harder for different parts of the South, mostly, then maybe all kinds of local politics is going to come into play, and this is going to be a difficult thing to get through the House.
I agree with you on that, Brian. And although we do think of it as a southern question, and this was Shelby County, Alabama, it isn't only the South. In fact, parts of New York are covered by this preclearance requirement, and many of my New York friends are surprised to hear about this. New York and parts of the getting back to, again, the case we were just talking about, it's the tri-state area in part, and various states that have had a problem in the past with equality in voting. And I think, of course, this does date back to 1965, but as you say, there was a reauthorization because of a concern that there were still a skewing in favor of white Americans at the polls. And we know that Congress, with all due respect to our folks in Washington, is somewhat dysfunctional. And I'm worried that they won't be able to get it done. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this opinion was authored by the chief. Although I can't say that I'm entirely surprised, I don't know that anyone will be surprised that this is the decision that they have issued today. I mean, even in the most recent presidential election, you know, many of the southern states had petitioned to change their voting laws. So I'm not surprised by the ruling. I'm somewhat disappointed, especially after we'd had the big movement for the reauthorization just back in, I think it was 05. So I hope Congress will do the right thing, but I think it would be a long, complicated, and fairly arduous effort to come up with a new formula.
So the Supreme Court has sent affirmative action back to a lower court for reconsideration in a somewhat fuzzy decision. They have now sent the Voting Rights Act back to Congress for reconsideration in a somewhat fuzzy decision. Battles to come, obviously. Both of these cases may wind up back at the Supreme Court before too long.
Jamie, this seems clearer than the affirmative action case.
Jamie Floyd, legal analyst and sometimes guest host of this show. I know you're going to be here when I'm on vacation later this summer.
Yes.
And maybe we'll talk before that. Jamie, thanks for all the clarity on the Zimmerman case and the Supreme Court.
To the extent clarity is possible.
That's right.
Yes. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. And we'll come back to the Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act with Emily Bazelon, Supreme Court watcher from Slate, a little later in the program. But coming up next, where do you go if you need an emergency room in Brownstone, Brooklyn? The answer to that question is less clear than it was a week ago. Stay with us.